1st, 1973. Four drunks getting married on the same day, along with millions of others out there that we don't know about. And we often argue on who was the drunkest that night. By the time I was 20, I was divorced from Dick due to the abuse of alcoholism. My sponsor, Mary and Bob, they stayed married, and this December 1st, they will be celebrating 25 years of marriage. From 20 to 25, my last 5 years of drinking, most of the fun had gone out of my drinking by then. I had no responsibilities. Dick and I were divorced. We had no children. I didn't want to do anything but drink. I managed to hold the job all the time. I was always a bit of a workaholic, along with an alcoholic. And that's a hard job to do, let me tell you. I worked all day and I drank all night. During those last 5 years, I moved 10 times. One of my moves took me to Manhattan on 61st Street and 1st Avenue. It was a 5-flight walk-up. I moved there on a Friday. Now, being from Staten Island, I never saw a roach before. And I moved in, and I said to my girlfriend, came with me, and I said to her, there's a few roaches crawling around here. I said, let's go out and buy some roach spray. Well, I bought a can of roach spray, and I sprayed the apartment. We went out for the evening, of course, to get drunk. And we came home about 5 o'clock in the morning, and I saw a few more roaches. I went to bed that night. And I still don't know if I was having the DTs and there was roaches all over me, or they really were all over me. But I moved out that morning. It was a very expensive weekend. I threw away a lot of money when I was drinking. And I probably could have went to Europe a few times with the money it cost me for that apartment that I had. I moved in on Friday and moved out on Sunday morning. One of my last moves took me down to the Jersey Shore. Now, a drunk being from Staten Island, that was the next move on a higher level to go to Belmar, town of Belmar. It's very hard to find a sober person in the town of Belmar. It was my kind of town. I rented a home that was in walking distance of every bar and across the street from the beach. And I drank all day, passed out on the beach, had a great tan. Appearance was always very important to me. Great tan, went home and had my quart bottle of Tanqueray and tonic to get ready to go out for the night. And every time I went out, I would forget something, of course, like every good drunk does. And one time I left my shoe in a cab. Another time I left my bag at one of the bars. And it was missing keys. And then I graduated to missing underwear. But the night I had my last drink, I lost my soul, and I can still feel it like it was yesterday. I went out to get drunk, and I remember distinctly not being able to get drunk. I couldn't get high. It was around this time I also started dating a guy who had just come into AA. And he didn't like the idea that I had this house down the Jersey Shore. And I remember leaving him home and going anyway. because alcohol was the most important thing in my life. And I went out that night, and I remember feeling like there's something wrong tonight. And I kept on thinking about Steve, who was the guy that carried the message to me. And couldn't get high that night. A couple of my girlfriends took me home. I asked to go home back to Staten Island. I wasn't driving at the time. Thank God I wasn't driving. You know, I gave up driving. I left my cars behind when I used to move because it was just too much. I knew I was going to get in an accident. And I went home that night, and I called Steve. And he told me to call him in a few days, see how I felt. And I detoxed myself for 3 days. It was on a Sunday when I came home. On Wednesday, Steve C. took me to my first meeting, the Sunnyside Group, Countess Moore, Staten Island. I walked into Countess Moore, very appropriately dressed. I had a tube top that would have, if I sneezed, it would have fell off. I had little shorts on with my cheeks hanging out. And I had 4-inch spike heels. I got a lot of phone numbers that night. All from men. I didn't like the woman in AA, and they didn't like me. Well, I went with Steve for about 7 months, and I was a raging lunatic when I got sober. It was tough when I was drinking, but I was out of control when I got sober. Some of you might remember that first year. How about that first month? How about that first day? I remember it like it was yesterday. Thank God for Steve. I keep him in my prayers all the time. He stuck by me, stayed with me. And when I was 7 months sober, he left. And it was the best thing that he could have ever done for me. Because I was getting sober Steve's way. And I was getting sober for Steve. When he left, I threatened to drink. That was okay, he said. And I found my own group. I got active, went to a meeting every day after work in Manhattan. At that time, the meeting was on 50th Street and Avenue of the Americas, Lifeline. I met Adrian. Met Adrian, an old-timer, who stayed by my side. Made me get active. I was secretary. I was chairman. Every day went Monday through Friday. Then I went back to Staten Island. Got myself a home group in Staten Island. Got myself a sponsor after many years. It took a while for me to find my sponsor I still have today, Sweet Mary. And a whole new world opened up for me. And that's why I thank God for Steve, because I couldn't have done it his way. AA had to mean something just for me. And I believe that's why I'm still here today. When I was 5 years sober, I was talking to my sponsor, and I told her that my husband and I had been divorced for a long time, 10 years, and that I was thinking of him a lot, and we had made our amends. We had written to each other. By that time, Dick was living in Texas, Austin, Texas, where he got sober. He had 4 years. I made sure I had one more year than him. And I called Dick, and for my 30th birthday, he invited me to come visit him. And when I saw him again for the first time, I fell in love again, just like it was when we were children. But it was better because I was sober. And I wanted him to come home with me immediately. And he said, no, I'm not coming home. So I think I'm going to think about this for a while. He wasn't as impulsive as I am. And he kept in touch with me over the phone, and we talked a lot. We wrote each other letters. And my sponsor kept on saying, read page 99 in the big book. And I read page 99 every day during those times we weren't together. And it talks all about marriage and how some people shouldn't be back together and how some people will not get back together just because they get sober. And she said, whatever you do, wait 90 days. So Dick came home in December, and we got married on the 90th day. March 29th, 1986. And we'll be married 13 years this March. Today, Dick has his own AAA. I have mine. We go to a lot of separate AA meetings. We just started celebrating our anniversary together the last 3 years. But the first 2 years of marriage were very hard. Two alcoholics in one home. Both very stubborn. You know, but the love of AA and the commitment we have to each other, to this fellowship, most of all to our higher power, are keeping us together. And we really have a very different brand of AA, Dick and I. On the way coming here, we were arguing about speaking. Dick spoke at the afternoon meeting. I was trying to give him the high sign, trying to tell him it's time to go, you know, cut him off. And he's going to kill me, but I did it anyway, you know. But we have our own friends. I use my sponsor a lot since I got married. Spend a lot of time on the phone. And I really learned to use the woman in this fellowship, what I like to call the woman on my journey. I have a lot of woman friends in AA that are not here any longer, that have died, that have passed on sober. Annie M. is always in my prayers. Joanne, Louise, all these wonderful people that have passed on. My father. And then those wonderful friends I have today. And I'm just here to tell you tonight that I could have not done any of this without you. I don't have a wonderful, glamorous story. What I've done with my life is remarkable for me. Colin really touched me today at the afternoon meeting. I thought he was a wonderful speaker with a wonderful message, like every one of us are in this room. And he said he did not know what his purpose, I don't know if that's what he said, but this is what I heard, didn't know what his purpose in life was yet, that AA was a wonderful part of his life. And it's so wonderful that we all can do whatever we want today with our lives. My purpose today is to do God's will. To do service in AA, carry the message, and to do service outside of AA for me is important, which includes the commitment I have to my family, my church, my friends that are not in AA today. Those people that have done so much on the outside. But I always remember, if I don't stay sober, one day at a time, everything goes. All bets are off. And my last words tonight are very simple. What I do with my life is I show up. I put one foot in front of the other and keep it simple. Thank you all.
Thank you, Francine. Francine mentioned Colin. Colin tonight has 19 years. Colin, congratulations. I'd like to introduce our third speaker tonight, the First St. Nicholas Group from Manhattan, Abu.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Abu, and I'm an alcoholic. My nerves are killing me. This is indeed an honor. I remember when I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was trying to find some way to get up here. It took 29 years, but I'm here. Oh, boy. You know, I'm here this evening because I drank alcohol. And as I look out here tonight, I was sitting there wondering to myself what it would be like if all of us had picked up a drink in here tonight. Gunfire would erupt. And God only knows what else. This just shows the miracle and the power of the transforming spirit of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I live each day of my life in a state of gratitude, because I have a lot to be grateful for. I was born and raised in Virginia. And I had an uncle who was the town drunk. And the man was a constant source of irritation and embarrassment to the family. And I used to always remember, oh God, I would never ever want to be like that in life. Back in the day, we used to, this was around about the early 40s, and you know, back in the day, if you're from down south, you would take a bath once a week, and you would go into town on Saturday to shop, and of course, some of the older people picked up the first drink. And the town was so small that the sheriff only came out on Saturday. And when the sheriff, he would come out on Saturday, and he would come down on the sidewalk at high noon. And when the sheriff came down the street, people would step to the side. If you was black, you got down in the off the curb and tipped your hat and said, "Good afternoon, sheriff." But my uncle had picked up the first drink, and he didn't do that. He slapped the sheriff's horse in the face. And that didn't go over too well. When my uncle went before the judge said, "I'll give you life plus 30 days. But instead, he was paroled to the tobacco plantation where I think he worked for 3-4 years working off that fine. But I swore, "Oh God, never in life will I ever get like that." But life didn't last long. When I turned 18 years old, I joined the Air Force. And that's where I picked up the first drink. After basic training, I went to the Airmen's Club with some other fellow airmen, and they ordered pitcher after pitcher of beer, and I ordered a Coke. And at this time, I weighed about 110 pounds and had a very high, squeaky voice and was afraid of everything that moved. And when I ordered the Coke, they said, "You're not going to sit here and drink that with us." And so I squeaked, "I don't drink." They said, "Well, you're going to drink or wear it." And I didn't want them to pour that beer on me, so I took a cup. It was the most vile stuff I had ever tasted in my life. But round about the third cup, a miracle took place. My lips flew open and my voice deepened, and I called them all kinds of unspeakable names. And they were laughing. They thought it was funny. It was young blood, blah, blah, blah. You know, for the first time in my life, I felt a part of. Because I used to remember going to dances, and I couldn't understand it. The guys, they wouldn't go over and ask the girl to dance, just snatch off the wall and go to grinding. I couldn't do that. But that night, after that beer took effect, I snatched them right off the wall. Well, anyway, during my drinking, you know, and going back to this thing with my uncle, I feared two things: going insane, because my uncle had also spent some time in a mental institution, and I had that fear of going insane and becoming a drunken bum. So very early in my drinking career, I learned controlled drinking. And God, that's a terrible thing. But anyway, in the beginning, I didn't have too much trouble. I was able to, you know, to do my work. Things was going along well. And I had the opportunity to go to serve a tour of duty in the Far East, or Labrador. And I chose to go to Labrador. Something wasn't right already. And due to the fact that I only got as high as the 9th grade, so the only thing was open for me career-wise in the Air Force at that time was the motor pool or the food service. So I went into food service. So when I went to Labrador, and by this time I had managed somehow to make sergeant, and when I got up there, I became the mess sergeant. And much to my dismay, there was nothing to drink. But seeing that I was the custodian of all the food, which included all kinds of canned fruits, and I had seen my grandmother make wine. She didn't drink, but she made wine for communion at the church. And I'd seen my uncle make these concoctions up, so I knew how to make wine. So I got me a big pot and peaches, pears, and some plum sugar and yeast. And to rush the process, I dumped ginger ale in it and set it down in the boiler room. And in about a week or so, it commenced to groan, and it commenced to ferment and foam. And we all got drunk. finally, we got some booze. We got a shipment of booze in, and you know, and I drank. But I was always on duty, on time. Most of the time now, I find myself showing up 2 hours early. Something was wrong with that. I was always on time, and as time went on, I made Airman of the Month, and then my drinking began to escalate, and my behavior began to become more and more bizarre. The commanding officer called me into his office one day. He said, "You're a good worker. But sometime that's, I can't put my finger on it." He said, "Maybe you said we said go down and speak to the." I spoke to the chaplain, and I spoke to a psychiatrist. And then, but any time I'd sense that, you know, there, I'm skating over to the edge of becoming a bum, I kind of pull myself back. Only for a matter of time, since I know now that alcoholism is a progressive illness. And it began to progress. And making a long story short, it was against regulations to fraternize with the Eskimos. And myself and a couple other alcoholic airmen, we took a couple fifths of booze and a couple cases of beer and went down to the igloo. And when we were busted, we were engaging in the most goatish things with those people. After that, I saw a submarine. Now, this is up there where the mouth of the Hudson River. And it's so cold, you know, that the river is frozen. You know, helicopters and whatnot land on it. But I went and told the commanding officer that I saw a submarine surface. That, and by this time, I had learned how to gamble and dealing from the bottom of the deck and stealing and just doing all kinds of things. To make a long story short, they told me, take a walk. Before we put you in jail for life, just take a walk. And so I had this bad conduct discharge, and I, you know, and there the fear set in. Oh, God, I can't go home. But fortune was on my side. The alcoholic mind was working. I had volunteered for 4 years of service, so when this occurred, I had about 3 months to go. So I went home, and I told some kind of lie, but I was in some secret service, and I got out early and some kind of nonsense. Tore the discharge up, and but what kind of job am I going to be able to get? Because I'm certain it wasn't going back to the tobacco field. Because there was no money in that, and I needed money. I wanted lots of money because also when I drank, I went into a world of fantasy, and I had sort of big house up on the hill, and I had to get me some money. Now I'm reading this newspaper, magazine, something like the National Enquirer, and you know in the back there where you know you can get a degree in psychology without going to school. And there was this place, it was called the Black Arts Club. No, but first it was the mushrooms. It said if you want to get rich, grow mushrooms. I sent away for $400 worth of whatever one is supposed to get to grow these mushrooms. Now, in Virginia, where I came from, farmers grew tobacco, wheat, and corn. Those were the crops. I went back, and I'm growing mushrooms. Back in those days, black people didn't eat mushrooms in Virginia, and white folks didn't either. But I announced that I'm growing mushrooms, and they started to call me the Mushroom Man. And I began to drink because when I was up in that place up in the snow, there was nowhere to go. You know, you was locked in. You couldn't go no place. So I had saved some money, and I went in a liquor store and bought a case of Top Chef booze and bought myself a white Palm Beach suit and a big white cowboy hat and the cowboy boots. And I went back and home. And announced that I'm going to become a mushroom farmer. I would wake up every morning and go out on the porch, and I would fanning in the southern heat and drinking bourbon and branch water. And then around noon, I'd switch to gin. In the afternoon, it would be scotch. After my supper, I had bought this one brandy snifter, and I would fill it up with Henius and cognac, and I'd slush it around. That's what they say you do. You slush it around, warm it, and sniff it. And by this time, they're down there in the heat and drinking all these different things. I would survey the vast acreage, and I would say to myself, all of this is mine at such an early age. My fantasies took over, and I could see the trailer trucks going to the marketplace, loaded down with mushrooms. The things that I needed to grow the mushrooms were still in the box unopened. Baffling, cunning, powerful, and insidious. Well, my mushroom, you know, like an alcoholic can't do nothing right. My mushroom business fell by the highway because I was discharged in April, May, June, July, August, September was coming, and like I'm saying, I hadn't opened the boxes. And when I did open and read these long, long, long pages of instruction, these things had to be grown in a specially constructed apparatus or in a cave or something in temperature control. I had no time for that. In this same magazine, there was a place called the Black Arts Club. How to be a witch doctor in 3 easy lessons. People in Virginia were superstitious. So I got together with my drunken cousin. I said, you put the spells on them, I'll take them all. Baffling. They stopped calling me the mushroom man and started calling me doctor. And the only reason I did that, you know, and I ran over these things, and it said act strange, and when it's thundering and lightning, go down to the graveyard and get graveyard dirt, then go to the stable and clip hair out of the horse's tail. And we mixed up these little portions, and I did this, you know, because when I'd go in the corn liquor joint on the weekend, and, you know, and I would look at you weird, you know, and go, woo, you know. And the person would buy me a drink to get me away from them. Well, after a while, people begin to catch on. You can't put no spell on me. Get out of my face before I shoot you, you know. But this one particular night, now, what am I going to do? I was in the corn whiskey joint one Friday, and everybody done caught on to my game. But there was this one man. He walked in, and he walked up to the counter, and he ordered a mayonnaise jar of corn whiskey. And he was standing there drinking his corn whiskey from a mayonnaise jar. The man looked like he weighed about 300 pounds and 6 foot. And I walked up to him and I said, I'm Dr. Clark. Woo! He said, mister, get away from me. I went, woo, again. The man reached down and he picked up his jar and he drained it. And he set it down. And I heard something that felt like thunder as I slid out across the floor. He said, woo, woo, that. Well, that had gotten around town, so I left Virginia in a state of disgrace, unless I left Cumberland, rather. And then since I was in service, I had a little bit of money left, and since I was in the service, since I was a cook, I decided to go back to school. So I went to Washington, D.C., and enrolled in Lewis Hotel Training School in restaurant management. And drinking, you know, every day drinking, not getting drunk and falling around and staggering. During my 17 years of drinking, that happened one time. I had learned how to drink, and I just drank sometimes just enough to keep from going crazy, just to get through the day. So if I run into you, so I could stand up and look sane and sound sane. Well, anyway, I got a job working in an Italian restaurant at night, going to school during the day. And the minute that I walked into that Italian restaurant again, my fantasy came back on me. And I became Italian. I drank Italian wine. I drank the little bottles of Chianti. You know, I'd walk around the street with them. I got run out of more Italian bars and restaurants in D.C. than you could shake a stick at. I remember walking the street one night, you know, and just sipping, had been sipping. And I passed, this was 1957, and passed a country and western joint. And they were in there singing a Hank Williams song, Jumbo Lie in the Crawfish Fry, whatever. I walked in the place and jumped on the stage and started singing with them. And all hell broke loose. It was things like this. Finally, I managed to graduate from that school, and how this happened, I don't know, third in my class. But at the banquet, and I was sitting here thinking about it tonight, and at the banquet dinner, in a blackout, I got up on the table and draped my arm around the ice carving and made my farewell address. It was then I'm going, you know, here I'm going crazy, oh my God. So I pull myself back together, go to Philadelphia. I work there for a while, then into Jersey. I work there for a while. And I inched my way here to New York, and this is where my madness crystallized. I got a job working in a bar on St. Nicholas Avenue and 148, between 148th and 149th Street. It was called the Rooster. And I would go down into the Rooster every evening. I found a place to stay, but I didn't have a job. But I had the clientele. They were gangsters, celebrities, pimps, and number runners. And people were, you know, they were dressed in diamonds. This is the place that I need to be. So I went to the lady that owned the bar, and I told her that I was an internationally trained culinarian and blah, blah, blah. And she said, it looks to me, she said, you have that kind of training that you would want to try the Carlisle or the Waldorf. And I said, I wanted my people to have the benefit of my talent. And my people was anybody that drank, and these folks drank. They know how to drink. And so, but I got the kitchen concession, and, you know, I purchased my dishes, because the lady that had it, she was serving little hamburgers and some French fries or some nonsense. No, because now my fantasy had come down on me, and with the alcohol, by this time, I'm drinking something out of a coconut, four or five different things. And so I became an international culinarian. So I had my menus made up, and I had stuffed lobster and shrimps and shish kebabs and smoked goose on a bed of fermented cabbage and all this kind of stuff. And the bartender looked at the menu. He said, man, all that stuff good. He said, but this is Harlem. Where's the pig feet and the chitlins? I was insulted. How dare you? But to please him, I put some chitlins on the menu, and I call them chitlins a la Leon Francais, you know, and with white wine, cooked in white wine sauce. Anyway, the grand opening, the night was my night, the grand opening, I had the white suit on, the white hat, the white gloves. And I came out of the kitchen with the shish kebab, and the flame was going into the ceiling. And by this time, I had become so obsessed with alcohol, if I couldn't drink it, I'd cook with it. So if you ordered a rib sandwich, ham sandwich, or scrambled eggs, it was on fire. Everything was on fire. After a while, the customers would say, they said, chef, bring me a rib sandwich and hold a flame. You know, they didn't want it. Too much fire. Wasn't too long before I was asked to leave that place. A drunk is always being asked to leave somewhere. Don't come back. Well, I pulled myself together, got myself together, stopped drinking. A friend of mine, and I was talking to him. He said, well, I know a wealthy private family who need a cook. And so I went for the interview, and I got the job. I stopped drinking, and I still had a suit, and I put the Bible under my arm, and I went for the interview. And I got the job. And I had noticed, you know, that in these people, they did a lot of my employee, he did a lot of entertaining, but I noticed he never drank. They had a walk-in bar. And, oh, God, I was in my glory, especially when if Hermione Gangold or Tallulah Bankhead came for dinner, you know, it was just wonderful because these people drank, and I would, while I'm in the bar fixing their drink, I'd get myself one. But my employer always drank club soda. That was strange. Then there were other times people would come for dinner, and he would say, there's no need, he'd lock up the bar. He says, there's no need because these people don't drink. Make plenty of coffee. I couldn't understand. He said, some of this woman would come, woman named Doris was always there, and they would have these strange conversations that about something you'd hear stuff like day at a time or something other, and something, I don't know what's wrong with them, but I didn't like them, I know that. Well, you know, and I continued to drink. Sometimes I would drink, and I would drink up the scotch, and then I would put, you know, tea or something in the bottle to replace it on payday. Go in a blackout, guests would come and say, may I have a scotch on the rocks? And, you know, and I'd pour that concoction on it and serve them, you know, and look on their face. My employer began to talk to me about my drinking. He said, you know, I think you may have a drinking problem. But that's about all he said. And I continued, you know, I'd slow up, and then I continued to drink again. But anyway, my drinking had picked up, and he had given me two books. One was the big book, and the other one was the ABCs of Alcoholism by Marty Mann. And I read these books, these stories, was fascinated, but I couldn't see at the time what that had to do with me, you know. So I continued to drink, and one day I came in, and, you know, I was just getting just ugly. And I came in, and he said, please don't drink today. And I had been out all night. He said, go in the bathroom and take a shower and get one of my shirts and put on. And he said, because I was just as funky as I could be. Because I'd been up all night. But I promised him I wouldn't drink. And it was one of those nights that here come these parties of people that didn't drink. 15 of them, to be exact. And, but the compulsion was so great. I drank, I ordered the food, I had everything laid out, everything was saturated with alcohol, everything was marinating, I drank, and these non-drinking people arrived. And I just knew that they would be pleased with this, my culinary fare. So I went to the table with everything lit up. And when I went back to see if they wanted seconds, they didn't want any. Most of the food was left on the plates. I said, so maybe, you know, they ate too many hors d'oeuvres and they were ready for these bananas flambé. So I poured extra booze on it so the flame would be extra tall and blue. And I took it to the table and the flame was dancing up on the bananas and I just knew, and I served it with great flair. And they didn't eat it. And I went into a blackout. And I went home, and I came in the next morning. Now, usually when I would go in the morning, I would make his coffee, take it into his bedroom, lay out his clothes, and then his breakfast. This morning, the man was up and undressed himself and made his own coffee. He said, if you don't do something about your drinking, we're going to have to let you go. And I became terrified. And I blurted out, I'll go to AA. He said, good. I was wondering when you were going to get around to it. This was 1964. And he shared with me at that time that he had 21 years. And the reason the people didn't eat that food that night, because it was the committee that meets every year to plan this particular function. And my employer was the chairperson that year. And so this was my entrance into AA. And so I got in that particular year, I came to my first dinner dance. And at that time, it was $9. But the highlight of that, I met Bill. I met Bill on two different occasions. And the book, as Bill sees it, my employer edited. He was the editor, or proofreader, rather. And this is how I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. Now I began to go to meetings, and I began now to get the significance of Bill W., and I would sit in the meeting. My mind was just gone. I remember hearing the first speaker that I'd ever heard speaking. The lady was coming up on 5 years, and she said she had gone back to college and bought a house out in Long Island, and she was getting ready to celebrate 5 years, and I began to plan my fifth year anniversary. My mind was everywhere. And then as I learned the significance of Bill and this fellowship, and my mind told me that when he passed on, I would be the second coming. And I began to get all the books, and I began to study. Now, when I drank, you see, I'm like I am now, always quiet. These things was going on in here. I'm always, how you doing? Fine, thank you. I'm one of them drunks that is deadly and dangerous because you don't know I'm sick until it's too late. Anyway, and I began to going to meetings, and I was going, oh, there's the most. I stopped drinking the drink. The taste for drink went out of my mouth. But when I came in here, it was like handing an actor a script. Whatever they said, do. That's what I would do. I would watch the old timers how to act. Those were the ones. They were the powers of example because I want to learn how to get old. You see? I didn't celebrate my thing. I was going back just a little bit. I'd go out all over the place on speaking engagements. Never went to a beginner's meeting. See, because I came in, was nothing. I had touched the hem of Bill W.'s garment. So therefore, I didn't need no step meeting. I didn't need no closed meeting. My job was to carry the message. And I couldn't wait till after my 90 days. I had rehearsed and I had committed to memory how it works. And I remember when I got up that night and I talked about the grace of God and how I'd been restored to sanity. And I wept as I walked the floor with the big book open like Jimmy Swaggart. And I looked at the steps on the wall. Then I looked at the old timers and I told them, I've been here 90, I don't understand how y'all been sitting here for 10, 20, 15, 20, and 30 years and still working the steps. I've been here for 90 days and I know the steps backwards and forwards. And I read them off to them. Broke them down. My show was so dramatic. There were some people sitting on the edge of their seat. But there were those sitting back. Going like this. After it was over, they told me, keep coming, it's going to be all right. I thought they were giving me a compliment. Back then, you come tell me, God, going to a speaking engagement, if you ask me to come speak, and I'm going to get around to ask you how large the group is. You ain't got but 10, 15 people, and I wasn't coming. I like them. God like these kind of meetings. This where down on Fifth Avenue and Park Avenue, get booked to them meetings. So have a stage so that when I'd walk and I'd talk about the grace of God, see, because at that time I done got caught up in the sound of my own voice and I'd gone off. But today I can stand here and tell you public speaking and being a good, so-called good speaker will not keep you sober. And I learned the hard way. It was only a matter of time before I had fell flat and I found myself back out there again. But I didn't stay long. I came back into Alcoholics Anonymous in 1969, and like I say, I've been here ever since, and it's been 29 years. But a change had to be made. I had to make a change, because when I first came around, what would I need with a speaker when I had touched the hem of Bill's gum a gum? Didn't need no sponsor. Didn't need none. Sponsored myself. But when I came back, I did. I got a sponsor, and I always came flamboyant. Always was flamboyant. I haven't dressed like this in 20 years. But I would come to the meetings with silk suits on, with matching hats and alligator shoes, and always sitting on the front, you know, and waving a dollar bill up in the air so you can see drop down in the basket and all that kind of stuff. Engaged in fake humility, picking up chairs and ashtrays, and I'd be damned if I wanted to do it, but that was part of the script, so I'm picking them up. But when I came back around and I got my sponsor, and he said, first, you got to take off those clothes. Keep your hand down out of the air. It's the best thing that ever happened to me, really. The best thing ever happened, because I wasn't well upstairs. Anyway, I began to, my sponsor told me, you got to sit down and start to listening. And that was the most difficult thing to do. But I did it. I sat. And after about 2 years, there was a change. I began to see it. And I began to get into steps. And I had a sponsor, was a stickler for the steps. He said, that's where your answer is. My sponsor was not my love advisor. He was not my financial advisor. He was none of that. He was my sponsor. And he said, my only job is to acquaint you with the steps so that you will learn how to work them in your life. He said, now, I want you to read this. Take a magic marker. Anything that you don't understand, come to me, then we will talk about it. Sometime I would go ask him something, and he said, can you read? I said, yes. Then go read it. And after you read it, then come back and discuss it with me. And even to this day, after 29 years, I'm a stickler for the steps. Every morning when I get up, I grind my coffee beans and make my coffee and go to the 10th step. It's a process that I do on a daily basis. Because this is, you're looking at a crazy person up here. You see? You're looking at a crazy person. So therefore, I work this program just the way that it was given to me in all of its simplicity. I don't add anything onto it. And I don't subtract anything from it. Sometimes people ask me, in 29 years, you must have a lot of sponsees. No, I don't. Because most people don't want to hear the truth. And the truth is in the steps. And if I give you anything other than that, I'm doing you a disservice. So if you're in here today, if you're new, you're in the right place and keep coming. That's what was told to me. Get a sponsor and make meetings. And today I live a very active life. Things have happened in sobriety that I used to dream about. I used to dream about being an artist. Today I'm an award-winning artist. My work is in the National Archives of the United States of America. And this year I wrote and self-published a book. It's nothing about Alcoholics Anonymous. It is nothing about alcohol. But I wrote it today because of this program. It has given me the ability to do things, to go through my fear and move on in spite of it. And I live a busy and active life. No one has ever heard me say it. I'm so busy, I don't have time to go to a meeting. Because when meeting time, I can lay the pen down or I can lay the brush down and I go and take care of my primary purpose. And what it is that I'm here tonight because of our singleness of purpose. Don't pick up the first drink and help another suffering alcoholic. Thank you and God bless you.
Reverend Mary H. of the Princes Bay Step Group, Staten Island, to offer the benediction and close the meeting with the Serenity Prayer. Mary?
I want to thank you for asking me to do the benediction. There was something that I would like to read to you. I didn't know I was doing the Serenity Prayer, and I will do the Serenity Prayer. I thought I had to make my own benediction, so that's what I did. Sweet Mary didn't come from being sweet. Sweet Mary came from cursing and screaming and crying. Reverend Mary is only here 3 years. Sweet Mary's here 22 years. I want to say something to all of you who've become a part of the fabric of my life. The color and texture which you have brought into my being has become a song, and I want to sing it forever. There is a divine energy in us which makes things happen when the paths of other alcoholics touch ours, but we have to be there and let it happen. When the time of our particular sunset comes, our things, our worldly accomplishments, won't really mean a great deal. But the clarity and the care with which we have loved and been of service to others will speak with vitality of the great gift of a sober life we have been for each other. May your sober days be filled with good friends. May you have many moments of peace of mind. May you learn the healing power of laughter and tears. May you come to know God of your understanding, a God of forgiveness and unconditional love. May your meetings and sharings with one another be many. May your courage and wisdom grow. May you love God and AA, and may it always be present in your life. May you see God within all people, places, and things. May you always strive to put principles above personalities. May you bless everything you come in contact with each day, the good and the lesser degrees of good. May you be grateful every morning for each new day of life and sobriety. And like tonight, may you continue to dance the dance of life, knowing you are loved and cared for beyond your wildest dreams. And until we meet again, may God hold you in the palm of his hand one day at a time. The God within me honors the God within you. Peace, shalom. And we say this serenity.